I think he has done a terrific job on Ebola in West Africa. You know, I mean, public health people are always much happier sounding the alarm than they are telling people to calm down. And when he's talking about, you know, not that they're happy that things are awful, but it's, you know, it's part of the soul of a public health person to issue warnings, you know, whether it's watch your weight and exercise more, you know, or it's, oh my God, this is a very serious epidemic and we need to, you know, we need to do more. That's comfortable for public health people. You know, when, you know, public health people don't like saying reassuring things. That's much harder for them. I mean, you know, you look at vaccines, for example, they would much rather talk about the dangers of infectious diseases than about the safety of vaccines. It's, you know, they find it easier. So, you know, I think Frieden has done just a terrific job, especially after, you know, after coming back from West Africa and seeing it firsthand. He did a superb job of trying to wake Americans up to how bad the situation is there, how desperately we need help. I think he talked the White House into a much more aggressive program than the White House would otherwise have done. It may not be enough. I mean, it may all be, you know, pissing into the ocean. It may be much too little to get the job done. But, you know, in terms of alerting Americans and alerting American politicians to the seriousness of the epidemic in West Africa, he has been superb. He's not done a terrific job, in my judgment, with Dallas. And he certainly hasn't been able to segue from Dallas back to West Africa, as he desperately, I'm sure, he desperately wants to, you know, and he can't because there keep being screw-ups in Dallas. You know, and as long as there are screw-ups in Dallas and incidents that look like dishonesty in Dallas coming out of the hospital and incidents that look like insensitivity in Dallas, like leaving the family of Duncan in a contaminated apartment for days, and now incidents that look like, you know, I don't know if you call it a breach of protocol or it might be PPE not working or it might just be that people are imperfect. I would vote for the third of those. But whatever it is, you got another case now in Dallas, and you've got healthcare workers in Dallas now that are, you know, finally, belatedly, you know, being actively monitored. So you got, you know, Dallas remains a big story. That's, you know, that's very unfortunate. So he's not been able to pivot away from Dallas, and he's not been good at talking about Dallas. Well, I think there are several things going on. One, it seems to me, is you know, not just Tom Frieden, but pretty much all the U.S. experts and U.S. officials talking about Ebola in the context of a domestic Ebola outbreak have been sounding much too confident. Anybody who you know, sort of knows a little bit about statistics knows that distributions have tails. There's the things that usually happen, and then there are the things that occasionally happen. And, you know, when Ebola in African villages, all we got to see is what usually happens. And the tails were pretty much invisible. And now you're looking at Ebola in a developed country with a good healthcare system, and some of the things that were the whole story in Africa are not the whole story anymore. Maybe if I'm more specific, this will make more sense. The claim, for example, that people who get Ebola have a sudden onset of symptoms that within a very short period of time they go from healthy and asymptomatic and unable to transmit the disease to terribly sick and unable to go out and about. And that's been the meme, or one of the memes about Ebola. You know, and, you know, it's apparently usually true. At least it has usually been true in Africa. It's clearly not true all the time. wasn't true for this Spanish nurse's aide who went and got her legs waxed, while she was symptomatic. It wasn't true for some of the doctors who got infected in West Africa and continued treating patients while they were infectious and while they were symptomatic. So, and what happens when you keep saying, you're very, very, very sick, as soon as you get Ebola, or within a few minutes or within a few hours of getting Ebola, you're incredibly sick. One thing that happens is if you're a hospital and someone comes in and they're not all that sick, you think they must not be Ebola, because when it's Ebola, they're very, very sick. Another thing that happens is if you're a patient and you kind of know you were exposed or you might have been exposed and you feel crappy, you say to yourself, well, I can still go to work. I can still go to a party. I can still go to a bar and see if I can't find myself a sexual partner for the night. I guess it must not be Ebola. So you've got both healthcare workers misled by that meme and patients misled by that meme. The reality is sometimes there is walking around Ebola. And sometimes there is working Ebola. And by sounding like that never happens, instead of saying that's not the usual case, what we've usually seen in West Africa is people get, a sudden onset of symptoms. They kept saying that's characteristic of Ebola, you always have sudden onset of symptoms. And that's not standing the test of time. That's one of I think, a bunch of examples. Another one that I think is not standing the test of time is you can't transmit Ebola until you're symptomatic. And again, we know that's usually true. When the patient, when Duncan flew back, flew to the United States from West Africa, Frieden said, I don't have the exact quote, but he said there's 0% chance that the other passengers on that plane were endangered by Duncan. There's never 0% chance. I mean, he's acting as if distributions didn't have tails, or he's talking as if distributions didn't have tails. And, obviously, if Duncan was genuinely asymptomatic rather than taking meds to hide early symptoms, and if what asymptomatic means is kind of sloppy, it's like if a bird sings in a forest and nobody hears it, is it singing? What does it mean to say of somebody, well, they think they feel fine, but if you look really carefully, you can tell they're symptomatic? That's kind of a metaphysical question, but the bottom line is, we know that people are enormously more likely to transmit the disease late in the progress of the disease when they're very, very sick. That's why healthcare workers are so endangered. We know that, but to go from that claim, which is absolutely clearly true, to the absolutist doctrinaire claim that was meant to reassure people that you cannot transmit Ebola until you're very sick. That's going to turn out to be not only not quite true, but embarrassingly over reassuring. And I think you've heard me talk about this before, Betsy. The thing about over reassurance in scary situations is it backfires. If you tell people that the odds of this happening are very low, they feel reassured. If you tell people that the odds of this happening are zero, they feel like you're trying to reassure them. And they don't feel reassured, they feel patronized and misled. Let's not scare the children is bad public health. You know, and all of these 100% chance of X, 0% chance of Y statements, which are, you know, I think they're being motivated by a desire to reassure the public, are backfiring. Any of that make sense? Yeah, I do see a connection. I mean, I think, you know, when you are absolutist, you leave room for absolutists in the other direction. You know, the issue of travel screening has become, you know, a fight between two extremes. You know, one side seeming to be saying, you know, we should do absolutely nothing to keep people from West Africa from you know, bringing the disease to the United States, and the other side saying, you know, we should shut our border altogether to those people. And there are all kinds of possibilities in the middle. I mean, why aren't more people saying, okay, here's the deal. If you've been in West Africa sometime in the last 21 days, and we don't care if you're a West African or you're an American volunteer, if, you know, or a visiting business person, we don't care. If you've been in West Africa anytime in the last 21 days, when you get to the United States, we're going to make you report once a day to your local health department for a temperature check and a symptom check. And if you don't show up, we're going to put out a warrant for your arrest, because we're real serious about wanting to check you every day. We're not going to refuse to let you in the country. We're not going to reopen Ellis Island and quarantine you for 21 days. We could do that. Lord knows we did it, you know, 100 years ago. You know, there's a long history of quarantining people because you think they have TB or because you think they have one or another disease. But no, it's a little extreme. We're not going to do that. It's a little too draconian. We're going to make you, you know, we're not going to trust you to self-monitor, because we know about human denial. We know that, you know, out of some combination of wishful thinking and you know, and a variety of other factors, people go into denial about whether they're sick. You can't trust people, anybody. You can't trust anybody to monitor themselves for whether they're sick. If you're serious about catching it early, you don't let them self-monitor. You monitor them, and with them, that's ever clearer. It was certainly clear with Duncan, who was, you know, who had lots of reasons to think he might be sick and might have Ebola, and he, you know, he was symptomatic for several days before his first trip to the hospital. So we know about denial, so we're not going to just say to you, take your temperature and call us if you feel sick. But we don't want to do anything draconian, and we don't want to do anything, you know, I mean, only one West African, you know, in these three countries, you know, one person in 2,000 so far has had Ebola. I mean, it's not like, you know, 90% of the people in West Africa have Ebola, you know. So we don't want to punish, you know, all those West Africans that don't have Ebola in unacceptably draconian ways. You know, but we also don't want to ignore the fact that the vast majority of the Ebola in the world is in three countries in West Africa. So if you've been in those three countries, yes, you know, sorry, it's going to be a pain in the neck, but you're going to have to show up every day to a health department and get somebody to take your temperature and look at you and see what your symptoms are. That's what we're going to do. And, you know, instead of somebody talking about that, you've got one extreme saying it's racist to close the borders, and the other extreme saying it's insane to leave the borders open. And nobody is looking for the middle. Not nobody, but not enough people. And I should add, Betsy, I'm just going blah, 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 blah here, but, you know, maybe you'll find something useful in it. I should add that the borders that matter the most to Americans are not, or let me say it differently, the borders that should matter the most to Americans are not America's borders. The biggest threat to America is not that someone's going to bring Ebola from West Africa to, you know, Chicago. If they do, Chicago will beat it, you know, and like Dallas, they won't beat it without any casualties, but they'll beat it. You know, the problem is, what happens if you know, an Indian guest worker in West Africa goes home to a crowded slum in India, and she brings the virus with her? What happens if, you know, one of these African Union soldiers that are coming to West Africa in order to help build hospitals and help, you know, help cope with the epidemic? What happens if one of those soldiers goes home to an African country with a rudimentary healthcare system, and he brings the virus home with him? If Mexico City and Mumbai and Karachi and Cairo all wind up looking like Monrovia, then we've got, you know, humongous impacts on supply chains. We've probably got another global economic crisis. We've certainly got political unrest, you know, all over the world. We've got massive movement of refugees as people flee. And then some of the history of pandemics, of plagues. You know, people flee. Where it is to where it isn't, and they bring it with them. The threat to America's security is not a couple of sparks coming off West Africa to American cities. The threat to America's security is sparks coming off West Africa to the rest of the developing world. And we're so busy fighting about whether we should close our border or open our border, we're barely noticing that what matters isn't our border. I mean, there are two things wrong with that. I mean, he has, as far as I know, he had no basis for knowing, and we still have no basis for knowing whether what went wrong was the protocol or the equipment. You know, I mean, in an industrial accident, you know, and I've worked with clients on industrial accidents for 40 years, and in an industrial accident, before you've done an investigation, you know, the main question you're asking is, to what extent is this human error, and to what extent is it equipment malfunction? The first thing he said is, it's human error. And as far as I know, he didn't know whether, you know, and still doesn't know whether that's true or not. So it's bad science, it's bad communication, it throws the healthcare workers of Dallas Presbyterian under the bus. It infuriates everybody in Dallas and healthcare workers around the country, and it was a foolish thing to say. My understanding of the science is the odds that the equipment failed are lower than the odds that somebody, you know, didn't quite follow the protocol. So it's probably a breach of protocol. What? Well, I mean, if he said it, you know, if he had said, look, we don't know yet whether it's a breach of protocol or it's equipment malfunction, but we know from prior studies that people get it wrong a whole lot more often than the equipment malfunctions, so that the odds are it's about the protocol, you know, I'd have no quarrel with that. But, that distinction is not the main issue. The main issue is, when people hear the phrase breach of protocol, what it sounds like to them is heads should roll. What it sounds like to them is, this hospital, which has screwed up several times already, screwed up again. And the meme it fits is, you know, crappy hospital doesn't know how to handle a difficult situation. And what it steers us away from, and, you know, I mean, you know, what I would have liked Frieden to say yesterday is look, and it's not like he said things, it's not like he denied this, it's just that he didn't emphasize it enough. He could have said, we know that this protocol is extremely difficult to do perfectly, and we know that this virus is so infectious that if you do it even a little imperfectly, if you make even a tiny mistake, the risk, you know, is very substantial. So when I say, he could have said, when I say there was probably a breach of protocol, I am not saying this nurse or this hospital misbehaved. What I'm saying is people are imperfect. I have no reason to think that a different hospital would have done it better. So the issue that he didn't serve up is what do we learn from this second case in Dallas? Do we learn that one Dallas hospital is incompetent, or do we learn that we're making unrealistic demands on healthcare workers? And if the second is what we're learning, then we, you know, then that opens up all kinds of policy questions. Should we have a SWAT team of specialists that go, you know, that go into a hospital when they've found an Ebola patient because they're specially trained and they have special equipment and they take over the treatment of that patient? Should we transport Ebola patients as soon as they're stable enough? If they're stable enough to special facilities like Ebbett, like Emory in Nebraska. And he asked some of those questions. Should we have more training? Should, you know, better training? Should we consider different PPE? Should we monitor rather than self-monitoring? Should we actively monitor every healthcare worker, no matter what PPE he or she is wearing? You know, if you're a healthcare worker that's in contact with an Ebola patient, you know, we will maintain a very good list of every healthcare worker that walked into that room. And they're all going to be on active monitoring. They're all going to be checked by a third party because we know about denial every day to make sure that, you know, because we know that they could have made a mistake. We know that, it, you know, that these protocols are very hard to do perfectly. Instead of acknowledging that perfection is unachievable and discussing the policy implications of that reality, it seemed to me that Frieden allowed people to go with the easy alternative hypothesis that, yeah, good hospitals can do this, but this wasn't a good hospital. And that, you know, that's not accurate, it's not good policy, it's not fair to healthcare workers or to the hospital, and it's not good science, and it's not good risk communication. That's right, he didn't answer your question. You served it up beautifully, and the person who came after you in the news conference asked essentially the same question. Is this an outlier, or does this make you wonder whether, you know, a normal American hospital can do the job? And he should have said, it makes me wonder whether a normal American hospital can do the job. And here are the implications of that. And I'm so sorry that in prior statements, when I said that, you know, as long as you're 100% meticulous, any hospital can do this, you know, that was kind of a stupid thing to say because, you know, I've been working on hospital-acquired infections for 25 years. I know that 100% meticulous is not an achievable goal. That's what he should have said yesterday, and he didn't say that. Look, let me talk about keeping people calm. Okay. I have no reason to think that people aren't calm. People are nervous, people are anxious, people are excited, people are talking about Ebola over the water cooler in ways that they weren't when it was only in West Africa. They're a lot more alert to it now than they were then. There are lots of false alarms. None of that is inconsistent with calm. It's what risk communication people call an adjustment reaction. It's a normal temporary response to becoming newly aware of a serious risk. And I mean, think about all the false alarms around the country. You know, there would have been, what, several hundred false alarms. To Frieden's credit, it seems to me, he pointed out that that's a good thing, not a bad thing. And the reason he said it's a good thing is because it'll help us catch cases. But there's another equally important reason why it's a good thing, and that is, it, you know, all those false alarms are the American healthcare system and the American public going through the absolutely necessary temporary Ebola adjustment reaction. Okay. And the example I'd give you, Betsy, and I hope you can use this, the example I would give you is after the anthrax attacks of 2001, there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of white powder false alarms. And people freaked out for a while. And then, you know, then people calmed down and there are still white powder false alarms. And now when, you know, if you work in an office that has a white powder false alarm, you say, oh shit, another white powder false alarm. And you call the person you're supposed to call and they come in and they're wearing their PPE and they take the white powder and they test it to make sure it's not Ebola. To make sure it's not anthrax and also to make sure it's not ricin, which it has been some from time to time. But nobody freaks out. I mean, you know, the false alarm isn't a news story at all. And even if it turns out to be something, it's a fairly minor news story, because you know we went through the anthrax adjustment reaction, and we came out the other side more alert to the risk, more serious about the precaution, but not in any way panicky or getting it out of context or freaking out. That's what adjustment reactions do for you. They get you ready to cope if you have to and ready to shrug if there's nothing that you have to cope with. You know, and we're going through an Ebola adjustment reaction. And, you know, I will make you any wager you want to make that, you know, if this dies down, and it may not die down, but if this dies down the way anthrax did, and if we don't have more Ebola cases in the United States, then 3, 4, 5 months from now, Ebola false alarms will still be happening. They won't be newsworthy. You know, the hospitals that cope with them won't be freaking out. They will have become part of the routine. And that's what you want to happen. You know, so if I were, you know, advising CDC on or advising the White House on what to say, I would validate and routinize the ways that people are temporarily overreacting. Okay, I would say, yeah, that's what happens. Americans are resilient. I'm not worried that we will, you know, that we're going to have some kind of post-traumatic stress syndrome. We're not going to have that. We're going to get through this scary period. We're going to get it into context. The number of false alarms will go down. The fear aroused by those false alarms will be put into context. And they will become a new part of the routine, just as responding to white powder in a letter became a new part of the routine. Two dominant messages today, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, one is, all right, going into the next, who knows what the next month is going to bring, but going into the next couple of days, you know, one major message has got to be, it is appropriate that people around the country are more fearful about Ebola than they used to be. That's I'm not worried about that. I'm glad of that. I'm reading articles that say fear is spreading faster than Ebola, and that's the way it should be. God help us if Ebola were spreading faster than fear. We need fear to spread faster than Ebola, and it is. Ebola will be brought under control in Dallas. It's obviously harder than we gave people the impression it was, and it's costing more tragically in lives and in illness and in effort. It's not easy to put these sparks out. But we're going to put the spark out in Dallas, and if there's another spark or two around the country in the months to come, we'll put those out also, and We want to do what we can to have fewer sparks, but we're not enormously worried. Any death is tragic, but we're not enormously worried either that Ebola is going to take over America and American cities are going to look like Liberian cities. We're not worried about that. And we're not worried that fear of Ebola is going to take over America. The fear is as it should be, and it will settle down all by itself the same way, you know, people's reaction to white powder after anthrax settled down by itself. That's not a problem. You know, the Ebola's a problem, and it's a problem we can beat, although it will be harder than we pretended, but we can do it. And fear of Ebola isn't a problem at all. Fear of Ebola is part of the solution, and it will moderate to where it belongs all by itself. That doesn't require any effort. That's the first message. The second message, and you know, let me say, the easiest way to get people less frightened of something is to tell them the thing they really ought to be frightened of. You know, so my second message would be, you know, from all the, you know, and if I were Obama or if I were Friedman, I would be saying, what the experts are telling me is the main risk to America isn't Ebola crossing America's borders. The main risk to America is Ebola crossing borders elsewhere in the world into countries that, unlike us, will not be able or may well not be able to put out those sparks. And where we need to focus our effort as Americans and as an American government is, you know, we need a Manhattan Project on a vaccine. We need, you know, real effort to find a vaccine. We need real effort to break the back of the epidemic that's ongoing in West Africa. And we need real effort, and this is this third one is the one that's been much too neglected. We need real effort to work on helping other developing countries find, you know, stop sparks, find sparks, extinguish sparks. So that you know, we don't have 10 West Africas 6 months from now. That's, you know, that's the priority. Yeah, of course, you know, if any time there's a case of Ebola, even one case, even two cases of Ebola in any American city, that, you know, we have to go into high gear and fight it. We will go into high gear and fight it. Did we get some things wrong in Dallas? Obviously we did. Is that Dallas's fault? No, that's not Dallas's fault. That's the, you know, that we're in untrodden territory. We're doing things we've never done before. And, you know, as a former head of the CDC famously said at the time of the anthrax attacks, you know, he said, we will learn things in the coming weeks that we will then wish we had known when we started. And, you know, I wish I could get Friedman to quote that. You know, because, you know, what you need to tell the American public is, yeah, we're going to make some mistakes, and we have made some mistakes, and we're making more, because, you know, we're dealing with something we've never dealt with before. You know, yeah, we've dealt with anthrax. I'm sorry. Yeah, we've dealt with Ebola for several decades. We've never dealt with a big Ebola epidemic in West Africa, and we never dealt with any Ebola in the developed world. So we're dealing with things we've never dealt with before, and some of our policies are turning out wrong, some of our claims are turning out wrong. We're changing the policies. You know, we're no longer telling emergency rooms if somebody from West Africa comes in and he doesn't have a temperature of greater than 101.5, send him home again. You know, that's what we, you know, we're not saying that anymore. That was a mistake. Our criteria for how sick you have to be if you've been in West Africa for us to want to isolate you, those criteria are getting looser, because we don't want to miss the next Duncan case. So we are making mistakes in Dallas. We have made mistakes. We will probably make more mistakes. There will be more cases in the U.S. and they will be tragic for the people who are infected. They will be terrifying for the people who are nearby. And they will be brought under control. No doubt in my mind, they will be brought under control at cost in lives and effort and money, but they will be brought under control. Where there is doubt in my mind is, one, can we find and mass manufacture a vaccine? Two, can we get ahead of this exponentially growing epidemic in West Africa? Three, can we stop West Africa from importing its epidemic? Not to us, because it won't be an epidemic here. I promise you, it is not going to be an epidemic here. Can we stop them from exporting the epidemic to developing countries that don't have our ability to put out sparks? Those three are what I want us worried about. Yeah, worry a little bit about whether there will ever be Ebola in your city. Don't worry at all about whether the person of African descent sitting next to you on the bus who hasn't been to West Africa in two generations, don't worry about whether he's going to give you Ebola. He's no likelier to give you Ebola than you are to give him Ebola. That's not something to worry about. Worry some about, how long it'll take us to get it under control in Dallas and how many other cases there might be. Worry some about how many more sparks there might be in the U.S. But you want an Ebola worry agenda? Here's your Ebola worry agenda. One, can we come up with a vaccine? Two, can we stop the epidemic from growing exponentially in West Africa? Three, can we stop the epidemic from getting exported from West Africa to the rest of the developing world? That's the worry agenda. He has said that one. He has said vaccine, though he hasn't focused enough on it. The one he almost never says is sparks going to the developing world. It's like, I'm guessing here, but why not? My guess is that CDC has two things it very seriously wants not to be talked about. One is the possibility of a pandemic throughout the developing world with all the knock-on effects that would have on supply chains and economy and so forth. And the other is the possibility of a mutation that would lead to airborne Ebola. And CDC seems to be doing everything it can to keep those two topics from being talked about. Now, I think airborne is kind of it's a sufficiently unlikely scenario that I don't mind not talking about it. But sparks are a sufficiently likely scenario that I think it's really harmful not to focus the American public's attention on what it would be like if Ebola makes it from West Africa to a dozen other countries in the developing world.